It's what?
Withers, Saul, lean on me.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's community. That's right. So there's a part of me that says I'm really caught because life is a lot easier if you don't know everybody's issues, but life is more significant if you do. So it has been an awful lot lately for our church. Just the things that are here happening and the things that are coming. And I just knew that when people started to feel safe, it would come out of the woodwork, and that's kind of what's happening now, is the brokenness and the pain. And so there's a part of me that says, yes, because that's what grace is all about.
Mm-hmm. So as part of that community from a couple of weeks ago, are the other church communities in the area seeing kind of the same uptick, if you will?
Great question. I can't answer it. I don't know. Because most of what I'm seeing is people inside the fellowship that are stepping up and saying, you know, we're in trouble. I got a call today from a man who said, can we meet? And I said, sure, what's going on? And he said, we're at the end of our divorce. Oh. What happened to the beginning of the divorce? Well, that was a while ago. In fact, they have a court order. They can't even be in the same room anymore. And, you know, and so it's like, oh, I wish you had called me, you know, a couple years ago. Okay, can't do anything about it. So we're there. And so it's, you know, and then you get the call from the Herrings and cancer, and that's a very frightening place to be, and to find out that you have lung cancer. I don't know what that's like personally, but it's I'm confident it's just a terrifying place to be. So it was God's grace that they walked into the restaurant where I was today, just after I left from the voicemail, and they came up and gave me hugs and thanked me. So when I was done, I went and sat with them and just talked for a while and processed some of the fear. So I don't know. All I know is that there more and more people in our own fellowship are feeling safe enough to say we're hurting or we're in trouble or we're struggling or I'm scared or I'm dying. And that's what grace is about. That's what the good news is all about, is reaching out to those people to give them a hope. We have taught our people in our culture how to die with dignity. We have not taught them how to die with hope. There's a big difference. Yeah, big difference. Okay, tonight we're talking about the pastoral, what's called the pastoral epistles. 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus. I will tell you that the majority of New Testament scholarship does not accept Pauline authorship of any of the three for a variety of reasons. We're not going to go through all the reasons, but I will tell you I do accept Pauline authorship, and I think there are very good reasons to say yes. One of the key reasons they don't is that they don't fit anywhere in the chronology of the Bible, what we have written. For instance, there's nothing in Acts that lends itself to Paul having written 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus. And so you have to assume that there's more to church history in Paul's life than Acts 28. In other words, Acts doesn't record the end of his life. He is in prison. But I personally believe he got out, and there's a very good chance he did a fourth missionary journey, which wasn't recorded. And so there's nothing that says these can't fit into the chronology of the New Testament. We just don't have it written down in the New Testament. So I'm not going to go through all the arguments for or against. I just gave you a couple of notes on introductory issues there. But they're called the pastoral epistles in theory because they're all addressed to pastors. They're really addressed to Timothy and Titus, and church history has referred to them as pastors. I'm not sure that that's the right way to refer to them, but that is church history, so I call them the pastorals, and that's okay. The theology of the three and the thematic content of the three are very similar, and the linguistic style is very similar. We are now at the end of Paul's life. Okay? So we're 2 Timothy is probably just before he goes to be with the Lord. And so my take is that these are probably written in the early 60s. if in fact Paul was executed 62, 63, somewhere in there. These are the last words of Paul. So we have made our way through. We started with Galatians. Remember back in Galatians where he wrestles with the whole concept of freedom and what Christ brought about, what role circumcision plays, and what does salvation by grace look like. And there in Galatians, typical of a young man, he's got that real brash part about him. You know, you foolish Galatians, blah, blah, blah. By the time you get down to the pastorals, you see a very settled kind of Paul. He's much more gentle in his language. He's not so harsh. And that has also led scholars to say, see, those are two different books. Well, I just look at it as, you know, 38 years ago when I became a Christian, I was a little bit like Paul back here, you know, a bull in a china shop. Now, 38 years later, there's been lots of tempering, lots of pain, lots of working with people, lots and lots and lots of water under the bridge. And I find myself, in many respects, having matured and very different than I was 38 years ago. Well, why wouldn't Paul be the same way? So as you get to the end of his epistles, you detect a lot of emotionalism, a lot of emotions, I should say, you know, as he realizes his days are short. He says, I finished the race. I'm done. In Philippians, when he's faced with possible execution, he says to die is gain, but to remain behind is much better for your sake. And so he wasn't sure, but he was pretty confident he was going to die. When you get to 2 Timothy, I've finished the race. My days are now over. You know? And there's a part of me, quite honestly, that resonates with that. I'm not ready to die. Don't get that perspective. But I realize that life has now passed me by. And so I have a whole lot of interest in preparing Stephen, because he's going to pick up the slack. You know? That's why I love your daughter, Bill. Yeah, you, looking over the top. Because my young theologian back there, when I'm gone, when I'm sitting in a wheelchair in a nursing home, you guys will be the ones doing what we're doing. And so life has passed me by. I'm no longer asking questions about career and all of that. I'm now investing into people with what I've experienced and what I know to be true. And I'm okay with that. That's fine. So Paul is at that place now. So he's at the end of life. So the things he talks about are very important. So I'm not going to spend a lot more time on the introductory issues behind it. What I want to do is actually get into the text and talk about them. You find a lot of stuff with church history. I have the outlines here. Okay. If you look, for example, we're not going to go through all of it, but we're going to look at several things. 1 Timothy 3. And Titus chapter 1, both talk about appointing elders or overseers. Okay, those are synonymous terms with Paul. There's several places where he reverses the terms, overseer and elder, and it could reflect, there's a possibility that it reflects his influence, his conversing in both a Jewish and a Gentile context. The concept of elder was more prevalent within the Jewish world, and the concept of overseer, what we know as bishop, is more prevalent within the Gentile world. And he kind of combines the two, and so I tend to see it this way, that when he's talking, by combining these two, he's bringing together two very, very wonderful ideas. The concept of elder is brings with it the idea of maturity. It's not in our culture. In the first century world, the older you are, the more respect you had. Not true today. It's the opposite. And which is sad, because the wisdom in our church is contained at a very high level. Told the elders, as long as we can sustain it, I want at least one elder on our board that is over 70 years old. Just because they've been there and done it and seen it. And I want them there. sure, the argument now is that, yeah, but we have generational issues like the role of women, how do we respond to gay marriage, all that kind of stuff. You know, I don't care about all that. I do care about it, but not from the standpoint of wisdom. I want older people on our elder board. I don't want this divisive people. I want older people. And so at our elder retreats, for instance, we often have Rob Mitchell, Ken Wiggins. Rob's over 70, Ken's over 80, and Frank Butler, an acting serving elder who's close to 80. And I notice those guys, their tendency is to sit back and just watch and listen. And then they start asking questions, and it's like, whew, yikes, those questions are wonderful. They kind of get to the heart of things and open them up. So the concept of elder brings into the mix a maturity, a wisdom, having been there, done that sort of thinking. The concept of overseer has more the idea of administrator, if you will. People that oversee the dealings of a church, whether it's finances or whatever. And that's actually the way our constitution is laid out. If you read our constitution as a church, the elders oversee. They provide spiritual oversight for the church, but they're responsible for facilities, for example, finances. I have nothing to do with the money other than get the budget ready and present it to you and just make sure we stick with it. But the handling of the monies, all of that is all done by them. If for some reason our budget, we're not meeting our budget, the elders are responsible for that, not the pastors. And we as pastors, we have pastoral oversight. We care for people and the needs of what's going on. And that's a good distinction because that's what we're trained for, honestly. Very few pastors are trained for accounting, finance, all that sort of stuff. I think I may have shared it one time with you, I don't remember, but Tim Glasgow, chairman of our elders, we're standing out here during the worship service, and it was full. And Tim said, how many chairs are in the sanctuary? I said, around 220, I think, something like that. Why is that? And he said, well, it's kind of full in there. And we kind of maybe have a growing problem. Yeah, it's kind of cool, isn't it? It is kind of full. But it's not my problem. He goes, what do you mean it's not your problem? You're the senior pastor. I said, have you read the Constitution? The Constitution says the senior pastor is responsible for pastoral oversight, and the elders are responsible for facility management. My job is to get them here. Where we put them is up to you. And he started laughing. He just said, I love your style. I said, so you figure out where to put them, and as pastors, we'll figure out how to help care for them and meet the needs of brokenness and sickness that come into the church. And that's wonderful because I'm not distracted by all of that oversight type of stuff. And and honestly, I don't worry about it. We have great elders. Last December, did I tell you the story in here of being down 19% in our budget, behind budget 19%? Did I tell the story in here? No? Okay. Last December, my basic rule with our staff is every elder meeting, I want you to tell them the truth in your area. Don't try to hide it. Don't try to cloak it. Don't try to massage it. Because the elder's best ability, best capacity for making decisions is based on their understanding of the problem. So they need to know the truth about things. So don't try to shape it. Just tell them what's going on. All I ask is that you just let me know before you tell them. So I'm not surprised either. You know, I'm not going to try to convince you to tell them a certain way. It's not who I am. So Jude comes in and she says, well, tonight we're going to have to tell the elders that our giving is down 19% from a year ago at this time. I said, okay. Well, are you worried about that? Nope. Not my area. I'll let the elders take care of it. That's their job. And she goes, okay. I said, so just tell them. So I said, but just sit back and watch what happens. This is going to be a fun ride. So she went, and as it came time for her, she said, the giving is down year-to-date 19%, 19% down from the same time last year. And you could hear, you know, as all the elders are on the verge of panic, oh, no, what are we going to do? So I just encouraged the staff, just watch the show. And so they sat back, and the elders are all talking about it, what do we do, and, you know, what's going on, what's wrong, and, you know, we can't handle this very long, and all of that. And so elder said, finally they said, well, we have two choices. We can increase revenues or decrease expenses. Spoken like a true businessman. And I said, well, there actually might be a third option. And they said, oh, what's that? And I said, well, let's go back to our basic theology. God is sovereign. Do we believe that? Do we actually truly believe that? Yes. Okay, so he is in control. Do we believe that the earth is the Lord's and everything in it? We do, don't we? We say we do. Well, let's live it out. So if the Lord is sovereign and the Lord owns everything, then he's making a statement of some kind. And money is one of those places where pure eldering comes to the table, because you can't cloak it. You can't hide it. It is what it is. So your job is to figure out, what is God saying? So they started talking amongst themselves, and finally one of the elders said to Jude, how much money do we have in our emergency fund? And I don't know, we have 160, 180,000, something like that in there. I don't know what it is. And she said, that's how much it is. And they said, oh, so we're not in any financial duress. She goes, oh, no, not at all. We're in very good shape. Okay. Where'd that money come from? And she said, well, in the last 5 or 6 years, we've had several staff changes. Whenever a staff member leaves, we take their salary and bank it. And so we've just built up this emergency fund. Okay. So one of the other elders said, tell me about enrollment. Attendance. How's attendance compared to a year ago? And she said, attendance is up. And he said, okay, attendance is up, but giving's down. She said, well, yes, we've said goodbye to 13 families who retired who were big givers, and we've brought in a lot younger people who many of them don't have either the capacity or quite the wisdom yet to give. Ah, that makes sense. So then one of the elders said, I wonder if this is like the story of Joseph, where God gave us 7 years of plenty to bias the time to mature younger generation. Now you're thinking that. Now they're thinking like elders. You see how that works? So all we did as pastoral staff was just provide some thoughts and a little bit of guidance, and the elders came to that conclusion. So they said, so not only do we need to not worry, we need to start telling people what God has done. This is incredible. I said, yeah, that sounds good to me. Okay, so I was in December. I think it was December. And then January, Jude comes into my office, and a day of elders. She says, well, you're going to be surprised. I said, I doubt it. Been around lots of blocks. What's going on? And she said, not only did we catch up, we're ahead of our budget. All right, tell the elders. So she got there that night, told the elders. Of course, they all erupted in applause, and let's stop and thank the Lord right now, which we did. And so we finished the year 2% over our revenue budgets. And that's just a faithful congregation. That's how the Lord does it. So you have these two things coming together in Timothy and Titus, this concept of elder and overseer, which provides two sides of the coin of leadership. And so there's so much information in these epistles, these three, that are concentrated on leadership, that we should pay attention to the fundamental message. And here's how I interpret it. It's real simple. If we do everything right, except appoint godly leaders, then we're in trouble. If the only thing we do right is appoint godly leaders, we will be successful. I've long believed that to be true. That's so critical, so important for us to appoint the right leaders. And so I put a lot of energy into nurturing and developing future leaders to be elders. So the new elders we were appointed this year, I've already got a year and a half of time with them on retreats, having coffee, having their families over into my house, getting to know them, talking to them about what we do, and really shaping them. And I've got another 6 or 8 that I'm putting a lot of time into now for the next 2 to 3 years. So the pipeline is full. When I got here, the pipeline was empty. There wasn't anybody in it. And so I've been nurturing lots of younger relationships. Anybody that says, I'm interested in being an elder, and those we say, hey, you might be an elder, come think about it. So we got 8 or 10 that are in that phase of life that I just spend time with, get to know them, learn what they're made of. I hear the kind of the insides of their thinking and their relationship with their spouses and how they're doing and all of that. So here's how I'm going to draw you a picture of how I see, people like to say we have a New Testament church. That language is not very good because I ask them, which New Testament church? You know, Philippians, where you have elders, Corinthians, where you have no elders, which one are you? You know, and so the churches are very different as you look at them. Some are small, some are huge. Corinthian church was probably very large, but it's in a very large city. And so when you look at leadership, here are the core, I'm going to diagram what I see as the core principle of leadership. You have a bunch of people that make up a congregation. In that congregation, you have a variety of gifts. Okay? Then you select out of that a series of people that have demonstrated godliness, spiritual wisdom, maturity, and they form the elders. Okay? This may include the gift of pastor, and probably down here this includes the gift of pastor. But I don't see anywhere in the New Testament where there's an office of pastor. That's a very that's a concept that evolved after the New Testament came about. Okay, I'm not going to say it's wrong. If it was wrong, I think the Bible would say it's wrong. But it does present challenges, very great challenges. And so what we've tended to do is shape church this way. So we have people in the church. Then we often have elders. And then for all practical purposes, we have a pastor. Or we may reverse it and move that right here. But any way you look at it, we've created a leadership position for that pastoral role. And everywhere I see in the New Testament, it's a gift more than an office. So from what I can tell in a current day church structure and ecclesiology, most people that have the gift of, that are in the office of pastor actually probably have the gift of leadership more than the gift of pastor or pastor teacher. That's what my experience has been. As I've gone around and looked, the complications that it brings to the table is that for pastors, it's very easy to confuse gift with identity. Because if you think about the way God has wired us, here's how I view it. I have the person, here I am, and I carry with me a certain relational style. You can measure it. There's plenty of instruments, psychological instruments that measure it. If you look on the disc, for those of you that understand the disc, I'm high I, very high I, influencing. That's what I do, you know. My second is D, but it's way down. S and C, they're barely represented, okay? The whole steadfast idea. No, I'm on the edge kind of guy. Let's live on the edge of faith. Let's all live on the edge of faith. Quit your jobs and see what the Lord does. You know, I mean, that's me. Nancy and I, we kind of have to balance each other. I kind of like having a job where I don't make enough money to live on. Because then I get to see the Lord work. Nancy, on the other hand, really is high yes, and she's an engineer. High yes, high C, and so she really would like to see a little bit more steadiness in the marriage. So opposites attract, and she wins, and I have a great job. It's wonderful, you know? Thank you, by the way, for the salary that you pay me. So I'm high I. That's what drives me. So we can measure people. Then when you come to know the Lord, you add to this a spiritual gift set, which reshapes you. And in here is where you have the gift of pastor. Okay? Now, then you begin to adopt roles. So, I'm a father. I'm a husband. I'm an employer and an employee, okay? I'm an investor. I'm a board member. I mean, we could go on and on and on. I'm a brother. I'm a son, that kind of stuff. So I have different roles as I move out in life. But one of them is I am a pastor and I am a gifted pastor. And it becomes very easy to get these confused so that my identity gets wrapped up in my role not my gifting. You understand the difference? And so I begin to evaluate things from the perspective of how I'm doing in my role, not how I'm doing in sharing my gift. That's the easy thing to do, and I think we have tons of evidence to demonstrate that pastors all across the land struggle with this. So if the church is declining, if the church is growing, who gets the credit? No, God. Right? Yeah, but I mean, if everything is going well, it's very easy when you're up front to talk about how what God is blessing us, and pastors lead you in that discussion because they like to deflect away from themselves often to God, because as a general rule, they're humble people. But if things aren't going well, where does everybody look? Why don't they look at God? If God is sovereign and owns everything on the earth, why don't we blame God?
Because unfortunately, many people see you as the physical God,
right,
present in the church.
That's right. So pastors, everyone I know struggles with that. Things don't go well, I get the blame, and there's a lot of pressure. Okay? If things do go well, I'm going to make sure the congregation praises God. I don't want the credit. And so it's a one-sided relationship. It's all downside. There's no upside to it. Pastors are lonely. They're very lonely because I spend time with all of you. This isn't a complaint. I love it. This is what I want to do. But most of the relationships are they're ministry relationships. Okay? Because I know a whole lot about your lives because you tell them to me. I know a lot. And so where do I go? So they have a ministry out there, several of them, that every pastor needs a pastor. And that's really true because it's very lonely. And this is the, honestly, this is the fault of the church. It's your fault that you guys let it get done this way. Okay? And so I've told our elders, I need you guys to be theologically competent. I don't want it to be the Jim Howard show. I need you guys to be engaged in my life. I need to know I'm important to you. I want you to ask me the questions. I want you to take me out for coffee. I want you to be my friend. You know? I need friends. Because most of my people by my church are not friends. They're very wonderful associates, relationships. See the difference? And so it becomes very lonely. And I'm not complaining. Don't hear that. I'm not complaining at all. I'm trying to describe the phenomena we've created in the church by doing it this way. And so pastors get this all confused. And so we had a guest here not too long ago, a clinical psychologist. We talked about that. I said, what is your area of specialty? And he said, pastors that reach the end of the line and can't go any further. They go off the cliff. They get burnt out. They go off the cliff and they give up. They go off the cliff and have an affair, but they reach the end of the line. He said, that's exclusively who I deal with. And I said, how's business? He said, sadly, wonderful. All right? Because you get it all confused. It really is confusing for pastors. So when you go back to here, what you realize is that the gift set of pastor, it's a gift. And Mark and I have shared many times, we want to be a gift to you. Okay? We're not doing anything that you can't do, quite honestly. But you don't want to go to the trouble to study like we study. So you pay us to do that because you're busy doing your jobs, whatever they are. And it takes a lot of work to be trained to do the level of work we do. You could do it. Every one of you could do it. But you have passions and interests in other areas. And so is this bad? This isn't bad at all. That you would say, well, let's pay someone or some people to do the work and teach us. And so Mark and I are thrilled because this is our livelihood. This is our passion. We live for this. This is what we want to do. And so we're very grateful. But do you see the dilemmas that get presented when we introduce different ideas into it? So that's kind of an overview of the whole leadership and ecclesiological principles of the pastoral epistles. Let me add to that a couple of thoughts. Number one, The noun for leader is always, with one exception, a negative term in the New Testament. It's pejorative. Okay, it's translated ruler, leader, that sort of thing. Ruler of the Gentiles, leader of the Gentiles, those who lead you. Okay, it's always negative, always. The one example is in Revelation where Christ is called our true leader. Every other cognate form of that term leader, so whether it's an adjective, a verb, a participle, is positive, and there are no negative uses of it. Now, it's hard for you to distinguish that in English. For instance, in Hebrews 13, serve well, submit to your leaders. That's actually a participle, to those who lead you. So it's emphasizing the verbal piece, not the position. So the noun leader is always negative with one exception, and verbal and the verbs and adjectives and participles are all positive with no exceptions. That tells me that God is far more interested in our function as leading each other than in the position of leadership, which I think is wise. So I don't feel the need to be called anything. In fact, honestly, it makes me uncomfortable to be called Pastor Jim. I feel awkward with that because it moves me to a place. I mean, I don't walk up to you and say, you know, mercy or giving or, you know, helper, right? So we single out the one gift and we get moved up on the pedestal. So we have to always be careful not to ever let that become something that is distracting to the church. Does that make sense? So people ask me, what do you want me to call you? Pastor Jim? Dr. Jim? Dr. Howard? I said, how about Jim? I'm great with that. You know, that's my preferred title, is Jim. Now, when I'm teaching at Denver Seminary, it's Dr. Howard. Not because I enforce it, that's a school policy. As a student, you will refer to your professors with the appropriate title. We're trying to teach them respect. Okay, I live with that. I'm okay with that. So the different contexts. You know, my kids call me Dad. You can call me, that's a great question. You could call me O Great One. Okay?
Or Most Handsome Man.
You could call me, you could just say, dude, you're handsome. Okay? And I'm just going to give you a hug every time you do that. That's actually more a question for your parents. Okay? Because I respond to whatever term of respect you would like to use.
So I don't have to yell across the
Dude! You might try that. In fact, let's do it on Sunday morning. What? Yeah. And see how, we'll see who.
Yeah, we can stage it during the, like there will be a certain time after you say a certain phrase.
Yeah.
Right,
you can say that, and then I can give you feedback on how many people laugh at me and how many people say, yeah, that's right. So the whole point I'm trying to make is that the people that are in leadership in the church, honestly, if you don't really know who they are, that's okay. That's okay. You know who I am. You know, it's a principle in the corporate world to make your boss look good, right? And that's appropriate. So when I got here, my staff said, our job is to make you look good. And I said, where did you get that from? It's the other way around. My job is to make you look good. I get all the glory I need because of my position. I get criticism with it, I'll be honest with you. But overwhelmingly, my praise file's that thick and my hate file's that thick. And so I just by virtue of the fact that I'm up front teaching you, I get plenty of glory. And so I'm always looking for opportunities to highlight the staff or the elders and how great they are and what they do. And quite honestly, that just increases my glory. Because if I tell you what a great job Jude is doing, then you think well of me. Because I'm not trying to hog the limelight. See how it works? So that's what Christ is talking about, first and last. Put others first. So at the congregational meeting, you'll notice we made a change when I got here. The staff used to stand up and tell everybody what they did. And I said, nope, wrong, we're not going to do that anymore. I'm going to stand up and tell them what you've done. Because I want to brag about you. Because you folks are great. Your chance when you get up is I want you to tell them what your priorities are for the next year. What is it you're going to focus on? Let me tell them what you've done, how great that is. And so that's what's wrapped into this whole concept of leadership. Yes?
How the Trinity is that the Father is always directing glory to the Son, and the Son to the Spirit, and the Father.
Yeah, they direct glory to each other. Yeah, I agree with that. I'm very strong on social Trinity. We look to the Trinity for how to relate with each other. And so the best, healthiest congregation is one where we don't have anybody grabbing glory. Everyone is humble and moving into the lives of people to make you more important than me. You know, so when we sit down for coffee, I love talking to you. And it comes out, things that are important to me, but really I want to know what's going on with you and how you're doing as an example. So these leadership principles all float to the surface in the pastoral epistles. So much emphasis is there. So let's look at a couple of passages. Look at 1 Timothy 3. We'll come back to 2, which does talk about men and women. Well, let's say something about 3 first. Here's a trustworthy saying. Whoever aspires to be an overseer desires a noble task. Now, the first thing I want to point out is that the phrase whoever, this is a technical Greek idea. It's an indefinite relative pronoun. So literally, whoever. It's the same pronoun used in 1 Corinthians 14. Whoever has a tongue, whoever has a word from the Lord, can speak. All right? So in 1 Corinthians 14, it doesn't make sense. If we're not careful, we isolate two verses that the women should remain silent and ask their husbands at home, as it says in the law. Okay? Well, it doesn't say that in the Mosaic law anywhere. All right? So he has that paragraph where he says anyone can speak. Whoever has a tongue, whoever has. His main primary concern is orderliness, not chaos. But then to turn right around and say that women shouldn't be able to speak as it says in the law, well, my take is that he may be actually be referring to the Roman law, not the Mosaic law, because that's not in the Mosaic law anywhere. So he's bringing balance to it, not because that's what they want to do as a church, but because he's bringing the law into it, but he's giving all the guidelines leading up to it about that he wants orderly and not chaos in the way we conduct our business. So here we have a similar structure. Whoever aspires to be an overseer desires a noble task. Now, the overseer is to be above reproach. To me, the way I understand it, this is the overarching characteristic of an elder. Okay? They are to be above reproach. And that, it's a word picture that's created that says basically there's nothing you can hang on them. Okay? That's really what it says. And then everything after this is a long list of qualities that describe the character of being above reproach. What are they? Well, temperate. Well, faithful to his wife. That's what mine says. That's actually a translation. Okay, that's a commentary. Literally says the husband of one wife, or literally a one-woman man is a very literal translation. So there's a lot of controversy around this phrase. What does it mean? This is the phrase that we do the most arguing over, whether or not women can be elders, because of this one phrase right here. Well, how could you be a one-woman man if you're a woman? Okay? So my point is that this fits into a string of character qualities. He's not highlighting the quantity, although that's a possibility in an age of polygamy. That is a very viable translation, that you can't be a polygamist. In an age when men had more than one wife, maybe say no, the new paradigm is one man, one woman. So whatever you do with that phrase will kind of dictate. But if you put it under the overarching umbrella of above reproach, so that's why the NIV says faithful to his wife. It's the concept of faithfulness that they're talking about. Temperate, that's a quality. Self-controlled, that's a character quality. Respectable, that's a character quality. hospitable. That's a character quality. Able to teach. Okay, it doesn't say you have to teach. You just have the kind of character where when someone's in trouble, you want to help them because you've lived life. All right, you understand life, and so you want to step in and help them. Not given to drunkenness, not violent, but gentle. You want gentle, not quarrelsome. Not quarrelsome. If you come to our discussions right now that we're having on the role, we've started a theology of gender and sexuality. It may feel a little bit tense to you because it may feel like we're quarreling, we're pushing back. But we've been working with the elders for 2.5 years, Mark and I have, to speak your mind, speak out of your tradition, speak your conscience, ask the questions, push back. Don't just accept things. Actually have dialogue and discussion. Just don't be divisive about it. That's the difference. So at our elder meeting this last week, a couple of visitors came, and it was a little unnerving for them because they're saying, well, I don't know if I believe that. I don't know if I buy that. What are you talking about? I was taught this and blah, 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 blah. They're doing exactly what we asked them to do, because when we're down at the end of the evening, guess what? They're going, this is an exciting discussion. We love it. And that's the way it should be, is people engage. They engage the process. So not quarrelsome. One of the questions we ask our elders, our new elders now, we've added this, is that these are some of the topics we're going to be discussing in your tenure as an elder, your term. Do you feel like you can engage in the conversation and support the decision of the elders, even if it goes against your personal theology? Because we have agreed as members of our church that in the essentials, we will be unified. Right? In essentials, unity. And what's the rest of the phrase? In non-essential, liberty. In all things, charity. So we define that as what's in our constitution, our bylaws, and our doctrinal statement. That's what we have defined are the essentials. So we will be unified in the essentials. But we don't have to be in non-essentials. If it's not talked about, we can be divided. We can have great conversation, engaging conversation. So, you know, all these new elders, we said to them, we're going to be talking about theology of gender. Don't know what your personal position is, but it's not until the elders craft some addition to our doctrinal statement, if they choose to do that, that's something where we have the freedom to disagree. So do you feel like you can engage the conversation actively as a Christian, as a mature Christian, as a theologian, no matter what level you are, and support the decision of the elders, even if you don't personally theologically agree? And they all said, yes, we can. Sweet. Because we don't want quarrelsome. We don't want that. Not a lover of money. Okay? He must manage his own household or family well and see that his children obey him. He must do so in a manner worthy of full respect. That's an interesting one. I was at two churches ago. One of the elders, 16-year-old daughter, got pregnant. So he came to me, obviously, in tears and said, here's what's happened. She's pregnant. And he said, so I'll be giving you my letter of resignation from the elders. And I go, whoa, 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 whoa. Where'd that come from? We're talking apples. Now we're talking, well, she's obviously not obeying me, because she got pregnant. And I said, oh, I think you missed the whole intent of the passage. Just pause on the letter of resignation. Can I go talk to your daughter? Are you okay if Nancy and I go out with her? He said, sure. So, I mean, he and his wife were traumatized, rightfully so. I've been there. I have a grandson out of wedlock. So we went to her and we took her out and we sat with her and said, tell us what happened. And she said, she's only 16. And she said, I have a boyfriend, I'm in love with him, and we went too far, and she started to cry, and she goes, I don't know what to do, I'm terrified. And I said, okay, my dad he's just wigging out. And I said, well, that's because your dad really cares. I said, when you found out you were pregnant, what was your first thought? She said, my first thought was, I got to go tell my dad, he'll know what to do. Is that a rebellious kid? No. So I went back to the mom and dad, and I said, here's our conversation. And they just wept. I said, your daughter's fine. She made a mistake. Is that a rebellious kid? No, not at all. Every dad in the world, when their kids make a mistake, hope their kid says, I'll go talk to my dad. He'll know what to do. Right? Are those words of life? So now, fast forward several years. I told him, I said, there's no church discipline involved in this thing. She's only 16. She's going to learn all the lessons she needs to learn just because of life. And so, sure enough, the very first thing that happened was she got taken. She worked for 2 years to make the cheerleading squad. She was only on a cheerleading squad for about 2 weeks, found out she was pregnant, and had to step off for health reasons. And we just sat with her and let her cry. You know, consequence number one, there it is. Right after that, her boyfriend left her, never came back, never saw him again. Consequence number two. Yes.
That's the difference between faultless and blameless. Mm. Blameless doesn't mean you never have any mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
To be blameless means you clean up quickly.
Yeah, you're humble and you. That's why all these things fit together to describe godliness and above reproach. You bet. So fast forward about 7 years. She's now at her wedding, met a new guy, and her son's there. And after the wedding, I walked up to her, and she said to me, the road to honor is really long and a lot of challenges. She said, yes, it is. Now, remember, she's only about 23 now. And I said, but you walked it well, you know? So we don't need to be so precise with this language. Put the whole picture together. He must not be a recent convert, or he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. I would say this, I love this language. I would say it a little different way. It's unfair to make a new Christian an elder. It is unfair because the spiritual warfare gets significantly increased with elders. Significantly increased. That's why I try to get with every elder every month, and I pray for them, and I spend time with them. How are you doing? How's your marriages? How's your kids? You know, what's going on? How's your job? Because our elders, and you probably would know this for many of them, they're under great stress. And they live lives wonderfully. They don't want you to know that. It's not that they're trying to hide. That's just not what they're made of. That's not who they are. So it's not fair to place a young convert as an elder. They haven't quite learned what it means to live life and experience the battle that's coming, the warfare. If Satan can, the fastest way to destroy our church is to get to our elders. Pray for our elders. They are good people. They really are. And they will often drop what they're doing, if at all possible, to do what needs to be done at the church. Brett Confer, one of our newest elders, we only have room for 7 pictures until we get the thing fixed over there. We have 8 elders. So his picture's not up there. I said, you're our ninja elder. He goes, yes. Yes. Keep it that way. You know, that's the type of people they are. They're not out there blowing their own horn. They must have good reputation with outsiders so that they will not fall into disgrace and into the devil's trap. When I first became an elder, I was relatively young, and that's 25 years ago. And so the elders asked me, would you mind if we talked to your supervisor? Said, have at it. She's not a Christian, and by any sense of the word, she's a raging feminist, been married twice, living with a guy. And so go talk to her. So I told her they were going to come. So they have my permission. Tell them the truth. So they sat down with her and said, what's Jim like as an employee? And she said, he's the best employee I've ever had. He is dependable. He is cheerful. He is encouraging. He's always helping me. Always. She said, I shine because of him. Yes. That's what we want to hear. Yes. That's what we want people to say about us. Not very often you get that kind of feedback. I wish it was on my performance review at the time. So so you can see what's going on here. And then if you turn over to Titus, the list, we're not going to spend quite as much time, but the list in Titus is very, very similar. Titus chapter 1, verse 5. The reason I left you in Crete. So Timothy is written to Timothy, who was in Ephesus, I believe, at the time. Titus is written to Titus, who's in Crete, 2 different countries. Was that you might put in order what was left unfinished and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. An elder must be blameless, There's that opening statement again. Faithful to his wife. A man whose children believe and are not open to the charge of being wild and disobedient. There it gives you a little slightly different picture. Since an overseer manages God's household, there it is. You have the whole management concept. He must be blameless, not overbearing, not quick-tempered, not given to drunkenness, not violent, not pursuing dishonest gain. He must be hospitable, one who loves what is good, who is self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. He must hold firmly to the trustworthy message as it has been taught, so that he can encourage others by sound doctrine and refute those who contradict. These are people that they hold the church together. We believe our prime directive is unity. We believe that's our prime directive. That's where we spend most of our time. So you can see these two books, they give you very similar, overlapping, nuanced, slightly differently images of what a good leader is. But when you put the whole thing together, it's a person who's godly and wise. So if we do nothing else as a church but point wise and godly people, we will do well. The church will grow. And that's what we do. Thoughts, questions, comments? Yeah.
Protestant groups don't think much about the word steward or manager or pointed out there, and let that be a part of the one that focuses just on the elder or overseer. Mm-hmm. I think it's adequate to look at that as cultural, theological parts too.
What do you mean by that? Say that, expand that a little bit more.
Well, I'm talking about how to steward a little bit.
That's okay. Right.
And so the church, the ecumenical term is based on that same word, homos. The church always grew in homes. And so home life and what that plays into and what that means for management really sets it more. Our business world is where we usually think of the word manager, which is a very different cultural concept.
Right. It is. That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point to distinguish it from the corporate world. I think that's really well. In fact, if you know our elders, if you don't meet them, look at their pictures and just go up and introduce yourself to them. Meet them. It'll surprise them. They don't like to be in the limelight. Okay? They're ushering. They're greeting. They're hiding in the back of the band, Tim Sealing, playing guitar. You know? The thought of putting up in front of the pulpit, well, they would do that because they know it's important to make an announcement or talk about something. But overall, they like best to stand out here and hand out programs. Say, how are you doing today? You'll see several of them talking to kids, and they're out chatting with people. That's where they like to be.
Mm-hmm. My background included more deacons along with elders.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a distinction between the two.
Yes. I did mention that in 1 Timothy. They in verse 8, he introduces deacons, okay? In the same way, deacons are to be worthy of respect, sincere, not indulging in much wine, etc. Deacons, we don't have a lot of evidence of what the deacons did, which means I think we have a lot of freedom. Again, they have very similar character qualities, but what little evidence we do have is that they're servants, which is the heart of the word deacon. That's what the word means, is to serve. They're servants, and they often serve the congregation by serving the elders. You see a glimpse of that in Acts chapter 6, where they were serving the apostles, because you have Jews, Hellenistic Jews, and Greek Jews and Jewish Jews, who in the daily distribution of food, the Hellenistic or Greek Jews weren't receiving the same share, and that created division. So the apostles, the leaders there, said, well, let's appoint six godly men, and their names tell us that they appointed Hellenistic men. Who better to go talk to the people that are offended than the ones who are their ethnic background? And so they figured out how to solve the problem. So they, the leadership there gave these deacons a project and said, would you guys go fix it? And they went and did that. So we don't have deacons in office right here. We do have the office created in our Constitution. We have lots of deacons running around serving. One of the things I would like to do is to actually elevate that and fill it as a position to recognize, to give them responsibilities. Here's the way we actually live that out now. Up until recently, the elders have done pretty much everything when it comes to oversight. Okay, well, that creates all kinds of issues. For example, every time we change treasurers, the reporting requirements on Jude changes. Okay? So every year or 2 years, we get different. Now, here's a report I want. Here's a report I want. And our elders typically are not CPAs and all that sort of stuff. So they're looking for something to help them understand it. It's not out of maliciousness. They're trying to understand it. So we have kind of a, for my opinion, a very squirrely accounting system. We have two accounting systems, actually. It's kind of squirrely. And so I put in my plan this year to create a finance committee, because the Constitution says as much as possible, the elders are to hand it off to deacons or committees to do to handle work. What a great place. I got half a dozen or more CPAs in my church. They know this stuff. Let's create a finance committee of people in our church that know it, and then they can come to the elders as often as the elders want to hear it. It could be every month. It could be once a quarter. It could be once a year. I'll let them decide that. And they could have somebody come that is well-versed in accounting and can say, let me tell you about our financial health and where we are. So that way Jude can work with the finance committee and she doesn't kind of run all around all over the place. It's creating structure at the same time. So there's an example. I think those would kind of fit under the category of deacons, because they're working on behalf of the elders to serve the whole church. Yeah. Any other thoughts, questions, comments? In fact, almost every one of these things you can find somewhere else in the New Testament in Paul and Peter's teaching. Almost every one of these words. Okay? Not being given to drunkenness. Not quarrelsome. Serving. Gentleness. I mean, they're found. They're scattered all throughout the New Testament.
I think the reason for appointed leaders, not appointed leaders, is you've got to have models.
Uh-huh.
Everybody's in the process and everybody's maturing.
Yep. Yes.
Or group guys. And so I just think it's the way of humanity. And all leadership is socially located, really, when you get right down to it. You either have.
And we are models to the congregation.
Whether unrecognized or recognized, but this is what mature Christian looks like. We're all trying to.
Yes.
Paul says, follow me as I follow Christ. And so what appointment does is it makes that clear.
Yeah, we're models to you. You should be able to look at our marriages. Look at the way we handle conflict and tension. You know, when I was diagnosed with bladder cancer, 6 months ago now? that was on Monday. And Tuesday, had a long meeting with the doctor to work it all through. And then I thought about it for quite a while. No longer than a week. And then at our staff meeting, I told the staff, here's what's going on. And they were initially shocked. You know, I'm glad. They were a little shocked. And I said, the doctor said not to worry about it, but I would rather place my confidence in the Lord to decide what to do and be thankful that my doctor's confident. That's easier than to place your trust in the Lord and the doctor says you're going to die in 2 weeks. So the real question is, what do we do with the congregation? And Mark said, you got to tell them. He said, do you guys all agree with that? And he said, yeah, you got to tell them. Not only will they join you on this, but you will give them a glimpse of how to walk through stress. So some of you may remember, a month goes by, and now it's up to the week of my surgery where they're going to take the cancer out. And so at the end of each sermon, I said, we finished church like 5 to 10 minutes early, and I said, everybody sit down for a moment. I want to talk to you as a pastor. I said, I have noticed in the last month a variety of responses to my cancer, but overall what I've noticed is you care about me, and that means a lot to me. But let me tell you what I hear. Several of you have come to me and said, I need to commit myself to natural remedies. If I only drink a certain drink, that'll burn up the tumor or whatever. And I said, I'm grateful for your concern. Thank you for that. I love that. I would much prefer natural remedies. But I'm still going to have the surgery, because it strikes me that it's presumptuous if I say, God, you have to work this way. But thank you for your concern. I appreciate that. Some of you have come up to me and said, we need to get every church across the nation praying as if, you know, the gang mentality will win God over. You know, I don't think we have to gang up on God. I think God's going to do what he's going to do. And so we're going to be the right thing. And I know about the parables that talk about persuading God and all that, but I'm not interested in, you know, you could tell who you want. You have freedom, my permission to tell whoever you want. This isn't confidential. Some of you have come up to me and said, well, if we only had more faith, then I would be healed. So we need to pray for healing. Praise God, let's pray for healing. I would so love for the get to the surgery. The doctor said, oh, we don't need to do it. And I don't believe I need more faith. I think my faith is good. It only takes the faith of a mustard seed to be saved. And I believe in Jesus, I'm saved. So which is the bigger miracle, being saved or being healed? I think being saved. So I like what the Lord has done. So I went through all the encouragement and counsel I was getting. And then I said, now, let me tell you what I get from the whole big picture. What I get is we really struggle as a people to know how to express our faith well when people are struggling. And we really want to help. And we have an idea that we think will help them. It's often based on our own experience. But we struggle with the right words. So let me tell you what my faith is. I absolutely believe that the Lord is going to do the right thing. That's what I believe. I fully anticipate coming back next Sunday and telling you they took the tumor and they got it all. But I'm prepared to come back and say they were wrong. I'm desperately sick. I trust the Lord. He will do what's right. The Lord will never do anything that's not in my best interest. He'll always do what's in my best interest. That's what my faith is. So as you're giving counsel to people, just think about that. Don't be so black and white. So I just talked through both services. I talked it through with the congregation, and that's modeling. That's putting myself out there in a transparent way. And the next Sunday, I was at church and stood up, and Mark said it because I wasn't feeling very good. And Mark said, they got all the cancer. And everybody clapped, you know. So the doctor felt very confident. So I think you're right. Another principle that surfaces from this is that when you look at the way elders and deacons function, they're always functioning in a plural sense. You have very scant evidence of what I call single point leadership. I'm in charge. Here's an example of it here, where Paul is telling Timothy or Titus, go appoint elders, groups to lead. But even then, he was very careful. Even in most of his letters, he's with a group of people. It seemed best to us for this to happen. So one of our operational principles, the way we have committed to do ministry, is we'll operate in teams. So when somebody wants to do a ministry, I say, great, tell me what it looks like to put a team together. So you're not bearing the full burden by yourself. You have people to share it with. So we have a children's advisory council or advisory board made up of parents that work with Annika. We have a student advisory board that work with students and work with Stefan. And so we have elders. There's a group right there. We have a missions committee. That's a group. We have a women's leadership team. That's a group. So we operate as teams, and that's because of the general pattern is that's the best way to protect each other. Okay, let me say a word about 1 Timothy 2. What a controversial text. And trust me, I'm not going to answer all your questions tonight. I'm just going to probably raise more than I answer. but I'm going to give you some thoughts. Verse 11 and verse 12 in particular are what is driving so much of the controversy. A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or assume authority over a man. She must be quiet. Those are the words that generate so much discussion. One of the things I love to do in the graduate program, graduate environment, is ask my students. It's really interesting, having been in it now for 15 years, how it changes. 15 years ago, how many of you belong to a church or are know of a church that follows these? And every hand would go up. In today's world, two hands will go up. Very few hands will go up. Here's what I'll do. I'll say, okay, let me read to you a contextualized version of verse 12. And listen to what I do. Now, you follow along in your text. I do not permit a woman to teach the Bible or assume authority over a man in church. She must be quiet. That's a contextualized version. It has been reshaped to fit our modern theological premise, many of our conservative churches. Okay, now listen to it. I do not permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man. She must be quiet. Period. When I ask the question a second time, how many of you go to churches that really try to enforce that? I never have a second hand go up. Because we're comfortable with women teaching us in university settings, employment settings, any number of places, okay? But we have framed this text to apply only to the church. When Paul is providing, I think, something in culture that is absolutely wonderful. You see, in the first century world, what we call church comes from the Greek word ekklesia. That was a very common term. That nothing special about that. Every gathering, the Masonics, the Masons, when they get, that's an ekklesia. You name whatever social group you're part of, when they got together, under Roman law, that was a church, an ekklesia. So the early church just adopted that word to describe, well, we're a church too because we're getting together in a public gathering. Under Roman law, women weren't part of those groups. They just weren't. Only the men were. You have examples of that in Ephesus when they have the big riot, and they start shouting, "Great is Artemis," that sort of thing. And they riot for 2 hours. At the end of the riot, the town clerk the whole time is probably running around pulling his hair out, trying to get everybody to shut up. He finally gets them to shut up. He goes, "Men of Ephesus, we are now in danger of being censured by the Roman government because we've broken the law. You're not allowed to operate in an unorderly or confused or disorganized fashion." That was Roman law. So we make some logical, what I consider to be logical fallacies when we read these texts. Number one, we assume that they apply only to women and not to men. So therefore, we're being restrictive. The truth is, every single word in these two verses you can find applied to men or the group at large. Where, of course, we're to be quiet. Of course, we're to be submissive. Those words are applied several places in the New Testament. So we create a logical fallacy by assuming it doesn't apply to the men, when the truth is it did. We know that for sure now, and the men had to operate by these same principles. Okay? So a couple of other thoughts about it. Verse 12 is particularly troublesome because of the word teach there. The word teach is used in the New Testament both positively and negatively. Okay? Often the word lord it over. You know the leaders of the synagogue, how they lord it over you, or they control, or they command you. That's often the word teach. So what our translators have done to help you out with that is they don't use the word teach when it's used in a negative context. They lord it over or they command you. In a positive context, they translate it as teach. So this looks like it's a positive word here. You're not allowed to teach. The problem with that is that we now have enough information to know that the word for exercise authority or assume authority, it is a what they call a hapax legomena. A New Testament hapax, that means it's a word that only occurs one time in the New Testament. It's hard to define a word when you only got one usage of it. All right? But we now have plenty, we have several examples outside of the New Testament to give us a pretty good sense of what this word means. And what it means is the idea of abuse or dominate. It's a negative term. In fact, I'm not sure we have a positive example of this term outside. So if teach is positive and if assume authority is negative, Paul just mixed his metaphors here. So let's take out the word teach for a moment. Think about what he's saying. I do not permit a woman to dominate a man. Duh. Probably should be a little more technical than that. We shouldn't allow men to do that either, should we? Now, let's go back to the word teach, which is used both negatively and positively. Forget the English context for a minute, or let's change it to assume it is a negative word. I do not permit a woman to command or dominate. It starts to make more sense to me when you put those two words side by side. That was good advice in every context, not just in a worship setting. That was the case, that should have been the case in every organizational structure. Hey, you could come in here and be godly. You could come in here and be godly. Instead of being pagan over there with Mark. Okay, the earlier, the verse before it, a woman should learn in quietness and full submission. This may very well be a precursor to the later rabbinic code, where you have the, at this stage, they weren't typically referred to as rabbis, they were typically referred to as teachers. The official term rabbi became more formalized after the period of the first century. Sometimes they're called rabbis, sometimes they're called teachers. It was really very flexible, it became fixed later on. But what we do know is that the teachers had standards. So in order to be considered a disciple of one of the teachers of Israel, remember Gamaliel, one of the greatest teachers that ever lived? In order to be considered a disciple, you had to have been raised from birth. You had to have been bred for that. So by the time you were chosen around 15, 14, 15, or 16 to be a disciple, by that time, you would have been raised typically in an upper middle class home with an excellent education. You would have memorized whole portions of the Hebrew Bible, and you were prepared to do that. So Gamaliel he has his pick of the whole nation. So he picks Paul as one of the students. Paul's an example of that, very well trained. And so he would sit them down and say, here are the rules. Okay, rule number three, you have to learn in quietness and full submission. I'm the teacher, you're the student. So when Paul, I believe, says, let a woman learn, it says a woman should learn in mine, but for technical reasons, I think it's better to say, let a woman learn in quietness and full submission. What we hear is quietness and full submission, but what they heard was, let a woman learn. Because women just got elevated to the status of men, equal with men, because they weren't allowed to. They weren't allowed to learn. By the way, Gamaliel, we have some of the work done by Gamaliel, and we now have enough evidence to see that he was beginning to change his mind on women. And so some of his teaching, Paul uses it. Paul's a student of Gamaliel. So Paul is actually bringing to the forefront some of one of the teachers of Israel's teachings. Now, wait a minute, we got to rethink this whole thing of women. So it could very well be, that what Jesus did was he introduced an entirely new picture by allowing Mary to sit at his feet, because women weren't allowed to sit at the feet of teachers. That's the real reason I believe Martha got so upset. It's not because she's working and Mary's not working. What a shallow view of both women. No, it's because he was committing a cultural faux pas. Women don't sit there. Jesus said, but wait a minute, she has the better choice here. And then Paul actually codifies it and puts it in writing. Let a woman learn. Maybe it would be clearer if he had said, let a woman learn as well. But he didn't have to say that. Let a woman learn in quietness and full submission, just like you guys do. Same principle. And I do not permit a woman to command or dominate or lord it over men. But the corollary is true. I don't allow men to do that either. So I think in the right context, this represents a very countercultural set of commands, not a repressive set of commands. Okay? Yes, Russ.
You haven't mentioned chapter 5 yet.
widows mm-hmm. are actually put on staff of the church there.
Mm-hmm.
They have to meet certain qualifications. And
yep.
have to be 60 years old and godly and these kind of things. But they're put in teaching roles in this church. And
mm-hmm.
So you can't.
Right.
Five,
you can't. You can. In fact, turn to Proverbs 31, the famous passage of the woman that every man wants to marry. This is way back. This is way, way, at least 2,500 years ago. Okay? I've heard this passage preached on my whole life, and when I finally sat down and read the whole thing myself, it's like, wait a minute, what about the passages that you didn't talk about in your sermon? Oh, that's another story. Okay, verse 10. The wife of noble character who can find? She's worth far more than rubies. Her husband has full confidence in her and lacks nothing of value. Ooh, think about that. Because of his wife, he lacks nothing of value. There's the first clue. Huh. She brings him good, not harm, all the days of her life. She selects the wool and the flax, and she works with eager hands. That's a statement that she's the one working around the house. She's working in the context of the family. It's not what you think of today. She's home doing the dishes. Because all throughout the church age, the mothers, remember a husband who would have many wives, the mater familias, was in charge of the entire household. Slaves, animals, everything. So she's overseeing the whole thing. She is like the merchant ships, bringing her food from afar. She gets up while it is still night. She provides food for her family and portions for her women servants. Women didn't typically have servants. It's a powerful language here. This is an accomplished woman we're talking about. And also, by the way, this is what we find in Paul's writing to the Thessalonians. Work diligently. Work with the heart, all every one of you. If somebody's not willing to work, don't let them eat. Every one of you should be characterized. So they're highlighting a woman who's doing this. She considers a field and... Oh, no, wait, that's a mistake. It's got to be translated. She considers a field and consults her husband and then buys it. No, what does it say? She considers a field and buys it out of her earnings. So she's profitable on top of it. Doesn't say she consulted her husband. She sets about her work vigorously. Her arms are strong for her task. She sees that her trading is profitable. She's a businesswoman. There it is. Her lamp doesn't go out at night. Sounds like some of our current day workers, CEOs that work really, really hard. She's working really hard around the clock. In her hand, she holds a distaff and grasps the spindle with her fingers. She opens her arms to the poor and extends her hands to the needy. This is the center point of the law. Now he's moved the discussion from business to this is a godly woman. She is fulfilling the law. Because what's the law? Take care of widows and orphans and the needy. That's the heart of the law. When it snows, she has no fear for her household, for all of them are clothed in scarlet. She's taking care of them. She makes coverings for her bed. She's clothed in fine linen and purple. Her husband is respected at the city gates where he takes his seat among the elders of the land. I've often pointed this out to Nancy, that the godly husband gets to sit while the wife does all the work. Hasn't gone very well yet, but we've only been married 30 years, so give us time. We'll get there. No, he's actually acting probably in the role of a judge. And he can do that because she's the one running everything. So he can sit at the gates and act as a judge, a wise man. He takes a seat among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them, supplies the merchants with sashes. She's clothed with strength and dignity. She can laugh at the days to come. Strength, that's often associated as a masculine tendency. And here we have a very early statement that it applies to women as well. We like strong women, don't we? I have a male friend, a good friend of mine, who says inside of every woman is a caged lion. Watch out when you open the door. It's true. She watches over the affairs of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children arise and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. I missed something.
26.
Oh, yeah, there it is. That's the key verse I want to get to. She speaks with wisdom and faithful instruction is on her tongue. In the book of Proverbs, this is language for a teacher. She is a teacher. She's teaching the law to people. Teaching the law to the household, which includes males, because she's in charge of all the servants. Her children arise and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women do noble things, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Now here, listen to the summary. Honor her for all that her hands have done. See it? She's being exalted for who she is, not who her husband is. Honor her for all that her hands have done. Let her works bring her praise at the city gates. So this is 2,500 years or older, 2,600, 2,700 years old. And we have early in one of the early documents being held up an ideal of what women are like. So now you come over to 1 Timothy, and one of the challenges that I always raise theologically is if submission and subordination is the primary part, if that's God's primary plan, okay, the male is the leader and the woman is not, then why does it come at the end of the New Testament as far as time goes? Why is it not talked about in the garden, in the law, in the prophets, in the wisdom literature? We see the opposite. Why didn't Jesus talk about it? Why isn't it in the Gospels? Why isn't it in the early part of the New Testament epistles? Why is it at the end? That's a theological conundrum, because I don't think that's what it's teaching. I think Paul and all these authors, every chance we get, we'll look at some of these. We'll look some more next week, but he is exalting women to be equal with men, which is you got a glimpse of it in Proverbs 31. Okay, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on verse 13 and 14 and 15. There's at least 16 interpretations of these verses. For Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not the one who deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner. But women will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith, love, holiness, and property and propriety. I just have a couple of thoughts. Number one is the word for in verse 13 makes you think that the reason I don't allow a woman to do this is because Adam was formed first. Russ, you'll appreciate this. It's just a Greek word, gar, which can mean many things. It can mean as an example or this is true, that sort of stuff. So he just may be stating a fact, because we do know at this time there were heresies beginning to circulate about what actually happened at creation in the garden. Okay? So you capture a glimpse of that in 1 Timothy 4, that in the later times, some will abandon the faith, follow deceiving spirits, taught by demons. Such teachings come through the hypocritical liars whose consciences have been seared with a hot iron. They forbid people to marry and order them to abstain from certain foods. And so you have a glimpse into some of this heresy right here. But it could very well be that women were becoming wealthier during this time. We have several who were actually sponsors of churches, you know, maybe Phoebe and a couple of others. And so, but there was a rumor, there was word going around that the creation story isn't true. And Paul's saying, well, it actually is true. All right? Adam was formed first, and even Adam's not the one deceived. It was a woman who's deceived and became a sinner. Well, guess what? In Romans 5, he said it was a man who became the sinner. It says just the opposite in Romans 5. Is he schizophrenic? No. He's adapting his argument to the context of what's going on. He's perhaps dealing with the heresy here regarding what was going on with women. And then he says women will be saved through childbearing. Guess what? That's the proto-evangel. That's the proto-gospel. What did God say to Eve? That your offspring, he will destroy the head of the serpent. So Paul's repeating it. They'll be saved through giving birth. And they were. That became Jesus. So don't get so wrapped around the axle. Don't get so bent out of shape over this language, because it's really very challenging. My general rule is never form theology on passages that the church can't agree on. and especially one that is as widely contested as this one. This is perhaps the most difficult to translate and the most widely contested in the New Testament. Fine, let's have fun with it, enjoy it, and move on. Let's don't build theology around it. Okay, now let me do one more thing and then we'll finish. When you put this in its entire context, this becomes a missional context, not a context for how the church should structure its gender roles. How does he start out with? I want then, first of all, that all petitions, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgiving be made for everyone, for kings, all those in authority, that we may live peaceful and quiet lives. He just said this to the women. Now it's applied to everybody. In godliness and holiness. This is good and pleasing to God our Savior, who wants all people to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. There's the overarching statement that defines the whole chapter. God desires all people to be saved. This is a missional text. Therefore, for this reason, there is one God and one mediator between God and human beings, Christ Jesus, himself human, who gave himself as a ransom for all people. So why did he send one person? Why did he send one Savior, one mediator? Because he desires all people to be saved. Verse 8, therefore, for this reason, I want men everywhere to pray, lifting up holy hands, and it is the word for males, lifting up holy hands without anger or disputing. Why does he want males to lift up holy hands? Without disputes, intention, but in worship. Because he desires that all people to be saved. Also, I want the women to dress appropriately, okay, with good deeds, learning in quietness and submission, not dominating men. Why does he want women to act that way? Because he desires all people to be saved. This is ultimately a missional text. So he's defining roles in the context of mission, that God desires all people to be saved. Therefore, in this context, I want you to act this way. I think this whole chapter then becomes a model for the church today and say, have we structured our gender roles so that it's missional? God desires all people to be saved. I ask the elders, point blank, the way we structure gender roles, does it hurt our witness in the community, or does it hurt it or help it if women can't be elders? That's a question that really needs to be thought through carefully because of the model, I think, of 1 Timothy 2. So that's the real reason he's giving this language on role definition here, is because God desires all people to be saved. So you take all those fours, the therefores, and likewise, and you work them back up, and you get to the God desires all. That's the reason why he sent one mediator. It's the reason he wants men not to argue and fight, but to worship God. It's the reason women should dress appropriately. When you put it in the context, you see that these are all very countercultural statements in the first century Roman world. So he's reversing what the world is seeing so that the mission of God goes forth. All people can be saved. Okay. We're a few minutes over. Any thoughts, comments, questions?
Amy was Diakonos of the church.
Mm-hmm. A deacon, yeah.
And that could be translated deacon, could be translated minister.
Mm-hmm. Could be. Servant.
And so she could have been their preacher, their pastor.
She could have been. Right. She could have been. We already know that Aquila was teaching. We know that the seven daughters of Philip were prophesying. Peter said, quoting Joel 2 at Pentecost, your sons and daughters will prophesy. Those are all gifts typically reserved for men. Yeah, that's a great point. So when you really put these passages, think them carefully through and put them in the first century context, you run around jumping up and down and celebrating that we were the first. The church was the first that started breaking that strong patriarchal abusive pattern. That's what the church is known for. There's some examples of it. Okay. Let me pray for you. We'll have a good evening. Go home. Father, thank you for paying very close attention to our culture and us within the context of culture. And Lord, helping us, giving us stories, commands, giving us ways of thinking that are always surprising the people around us with goodness and with truth and wonderful things. Thank you for that. In Jesus' name, amen.